Fun Fact Fodder performances by Sorry Edith, Rain Cloud, and No Mothers.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to Finding the Funny here on CITR 101.9. As always, we'd like to take this moment to thank the Musqueam people for housing us here at CITR on their ancestral, traditional, and unceded territory. And now, the moment you've been waiting for. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Finding the Funny. With your host, Nika McEwen. Ladies and gentlemen, here we are with another episode of Finding the Funny. I'm your host, Nika McEwen, and today's episode is personal comedy. I got the idea for this episode after watching Patton Oswalt's Annihilation on Netflix. For any of you that haven't seen it, it's a really, really well-done special. And in the special, he discusses the passing of his wife. And it actually reminded me to another Netflix special I had watched. That special being Neil Brennan's Three Mics, wherein which he has a mic for one-liners, a mic for jokes, and a mic for lengthier stories. And the stories touch on emotional and difficult times from his past. I have an insane amount of respect for comedians who talk about difficult subject matter in their stand-up, and especially if they're able to make it funny, because that's such a great part of what stand-up comedy does, is it allows us to talk about things in a different light so that we can look at them from a different way and maybe get out important parts of our feelings and emotions in a way that we don't feel uncomfortable because there's comedy behind it. So this first clip of the episode is going to be Patton Oswalt on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert discussing the passing of his wife in stand-up.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. You know, it's weird. Doing that, like me sitting here now talking to you, This part, very easy.
Yeah.
And then also staying home, curled up in a fetal position and not leaving for days,
right.
Super easy.
There might be a few people out there just to explain sadly, 6 months ago, you lost your wife, Michelle.
Yes.
For the people who don't know that, now you've been very public about it, about your grief in ways that is, I think, has been very appreciated by people who have experienced grief, because there are a lot of times that people don't talk about it. And they don't want to hear it sometimes because they feel that almost like it's contagious. It's so terrible for people to contemplate. But you sharing with other people, I think, has been a beautiful gift for someone to give, to know that other people are not alone. Well, so thank you for that.
Thank you. I think it's a way for me to. When you said it feels contagious, it feels like you've summoned this virus and you've become this avatar of loss to kind of de-summon it. The more you talk openly about what it is and put more light onto it, people can see all the angles and say, oh, okay, that is horrible, but there's life on either side of it and it's somehow manageable. And I mean, I've heard from people that have gone through unbelievable, like loss that I can't even wrap my head around in the depths of my loss, but you can, and there are these really long messages that I'll get, and you realize the length of the message is them beginning to talk about it and write about it, and then it just comes pouring out, if you don't talk about it, then grief really gets to set up and fortify its positions inside of you and begin to immobilize you. But the more you talk, the more you expose it to the air and to the light, then grief doesn't get a chance to organize itself, and then you can maybe move on a little better and a little easier. That's been my experience in these 6 months.
Well, how is, you've been away from performing and now you're coming back to performing.
Yeah.
How has that been? I must imagine that when you first considered coming to do comedy, that must have been a weird feeling to do.
It was really weird, the process of getting to do the show. I mean, again, once I get on stage and start talking, it weirdly becomes okay because the stage was always a safe place for me. It was a safety place that I was used to. But it's the getting in the car and driving and thinking about people are coming to a room and I've been through this loss and I'm going to talk. How dare I talk about this thing? But then it, in a really weird way, it takes you out of your own head and your own ego to go, well, wait a minute. Everyone in that room, each individual person, you're all meeting at this moment of, you don't know what they've been through that day or in their lives or what they have going on. So if you all meet together at that one thing where you're all denying whatever is bad for just an hour up in the light of telling jokes and being ridiculous, there's something like, it's weird how both me and the audiences that I've been performing for, we all just kind of rise to the occasion, and it's a way to make the darkness feel uncomfortable with itself for a little bit, you know.
Grief cannot be fixed; it can only be experienced.
No,
and unless you allow yourself to experience it, it will stay.
Yeah, and it can't be remedied; it must be endured, and it's the endurance, weirdly enough, that becomes the remedy. Does that make a little?
I do. You have. It's the acknowledgement of it. It's the acknowledgement of it. It's like a demon that must be named, and then it can go.
Yeah. If you can name it, you can manage it. If you can mock it, you can manage it. I'm quoting Todd Glass right there, but that is, if you can mock it, you can manage it. It robs it of its power.
The devil cannot endure mockery.
Not too crazy about if you're being entertained or are laughing at what is supposed to be terrifying you, it just takes all of its strength away.
You can't laugh and be afraid at the same time is what I like to say.
Yes, exactly.
Well, you're not doing this
unless
alone.
Unless you're on bath salts.
That's true.
Then
that is true.
You can do both.
Then your laughter is actually terrifying.
So that was a short clip from The Late Show with Stephen Colbert when he had Patton Oswalt on the show. Now, although there weren't a whole lot of jokes in that, he was mostly discussing grief and the concept of it. In Annihilation, he has some amazing jokes that rise out of his pain, and that's what this episode is all about, is taking circumstances of absolute despair and trying to find the comedy in them, because it's one of the healthiest ways to deal with them, in my opinion. Fans listening right now, it'll be a quick warning content for all the listeners.
As a station, we believe in playing content with artistic and cultural merit, and sometimes that category includes material which can be construed as offensive. For those who have children nearby or are sensitive to provocative material, the following broadcast may have strong language, themes, or be otherwise objectionable. Please consider tuning out and revisiting CITR after this program.
And now we'll be right back after an ad from our sponsors.
Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate. Remember Pilate from the New Testament?
What is Pilate? He fiddled while...
Just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Watch Show on Virginia.
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
Hey, everybody. We are back with more Finding the Funny here on CITR 101.9, and we want to do a shout-out to our social media. You can find us at Finding the Funny on Twitter. Check out all the awesome things we'll be posting, whether it be certain stand-up comedy things going on in Vancouver, or maybe it's just about our upcoming episodes, or maybe we want to hear from you, the fans, about what you think about the episodes, and we'll talk about it in further episodes. Any of this is possible. Just check us out at Finding the Funny on Twitter. And now, ladies and gents, from his special Three Mics, this is Neil Brennan.
So, back to my dad. I almost couldn't get a one-man show license unless I did a full monologue about my dad. Like I said, violent guy, abusive, volcanic temper, but he grew up in a really tough background. Like, he was one of 13 kids born in the heart of the Depression to Irish immigrant parents. His twin died when he was like 6 months old. Apparently, his parents put my dad up for adoption at some point. They just like openly, so like a couple just came and took him for a test drive and brought him back. Like, that was the system. So needless to say, he wasn't approaching emotional things with a full cup. So I basically just tried to stay away from him. That was my whole MO. Like, I started work when I was like 11, and then you know, moved to New York when I was 17. And we basically just got into a pattern of me getting my hopes up and then him kind of letting me down. Because no one wants a bad relationship with their father. That's the thing that he never understood. It's like, I wanted a relationship with him, so I would always try, you know, despite his behavior. Like, when Half-Baked came out, it wasn't well-reviewed, and I'd say correctly. But my dad was, like, such a narcissist that he was, like, mad at me somehow. Like, I'd embarrassed him. You know, famously, Harry Truman, the president, when he was sitting president, his daughter did a play and got a bad review. And Truman wrote the reviewer a nasty note threatening to fight him on White House stationery. Yeah, like, that's the way you're supposed to do it. Whereas I feel like my dad would have written, like, read your review of Neil's movie, spot on. And then when Chappelle's Show got popular, then he was interested again. But I was like, I don't, man, come on, take a walk. Like, I don't need you when things are going well. I need you all the time, you know? Then he started to get sick. And everyone I knew that had an ill parent was like, dude, you got to make it right with them. I'm telling you, if you don't, you're really going to regret it. So I was like, okay. I took it to heart, and I wrote him a long note, and I expressed all the things that I was grateful to him for and all the things that I was angry at him about, and sent it his way, and didn't hear back for 9 months. And then I got a voicemail where he goes, hey, Neil, it's your dad. I never checked that email address, and I just checked it, and I got to say, I read your note. Pretty fair. So I was like, okay, cool. So, like, he's going to take responsibility for his behavior. That's great. Like, this could really help. So we started talking, and we actually got along really well. Like we had rapport. Like, we'd read some of the same books and, like, felt the same way about things. And like, I was definitely his son. It was cool. Then his health took a turn for the worse. And my sister was like, you should really come to Chicago and say goodbye, potentially. So I went to Chicago, and I was hopeful, you know? Because when you have a parent like that, it really fractures the whole family. So I went there hopeful, like, he's taking responsibility for his behavior, and hopefully we can kind of all kind of coalesce around him. And so I go to his hospital room, and within 5 minutes of sitting there, he's trying to get me to trash two of my brothers. I was like, God damn, why did I think this guy was going to be any different? Like, this is just who he is. And I spent the day with him that day, and then I went back the next day and the day after that. And on the fourth day, I got a phone call from my sister, and she goes, hey, Neil, did you tell Dad you didn't want to be in his will? And I was like, why? Let me guess, I'm not in it? She's like, yeah, you're not in it, but he said he wants to change it. Just come down here and talk to him about it. It's like, okay. So I go down there and I talk to him, and he goes, Neil, do you remember telling me to take my money and shove it up my ass? And I was like, I remember the sentiment. I don't think I would have said it in such a hacky 1970s way. Basically, when he came around during Chappelle's Show, he was always, like, lording money over my brothers and sisters and their kids, and whether he was going to send them to help them with school or not. And it was just, he was just manipulative about it. And I was like, I'm not playing your game, man. Stop with that money talk. And he took it to heart and wrote me out of his will. And we sat in his hospital room in silence. And I could tell he wanted me to grovel for it. I finally said to him, I was like, you know, Dad, I'd rather you put me in your will than not. Just, I don't want to have to beg. And he fell asleep. He didn't answer. And I had to leave town. I had a job to do in New York that I had to go to for like 3 days, but I was going to try to make it back. But it was that hard end of life thing for someone where it's like, I don't know if I'm going to make it back or if I should just like quit. I didn't know what to do. So I was like, all right, I'll just try to make it back. But I knew this might be the last time I would see him. So it was hard to know how to be affectionate with a guy I hadn't been affectionate with in 30 years. So I just, like, kissed my hand and put it on his forehead and just, like, empathized with a dying man, you know? And on my way out, I saw my sister, and she's like, hey, just so you know, he wants to put you in the will. There's a lawyer coming tomorrow. It's going to be taken care of. And I was like, okay, cool. So I went to New York, and 2 days later, he died. So I didn't get to see him again. And the funeral was going to be the next week. And I didn't want to go to the funeral because, like I said, the family doesn't all get along. And I felt like I had done the difficult part. I had gone to my father's deathbed and tried to make it right with him. And I didn't want to participate in the theater of a funeral. But through various levers of guilt, I ended up going. And it was tense and awkward. And I stayed for a while and then left town. And the next week, I got an email on my phone, and it said, like, the will of Daniel J. Brennan. It's like, well, I guess I'll open it, which, by the way, isn't in the commercials. It's not like, listen to music, take selfies, open wills. So I open it on the street in New York, and I'm scrolling down, and it says, like, my son Joe gets 1/10. My daughter Sheila gets 1/10. Then it got to me. And it said, my son Neil gets nothing. Which still hurts, you know? And I know you're thinking, didn't you just say you got a little bit of gold? Yeah, but it wasn't about that. It was like, if my dad was giving out blankets, I would have wanted a blanket, you know? Just felt like a little flick to the back of the ear, like, this is what your relationship with me was like, and now it's over, and there's nothing you can do. There's a silver lining to it. You got to squint to see it, but I guess I choose to squint. When things had thawed between my father and I was talking to him one day, and I go, Dad, I feel like you didn't love us. And he's like, yeah, you're right, I didn't. Which is a really horrible thing to hear, but it also felt good. Because my whole life, I felt like I was insane, because I say to people, like, I don't think my dad loves me. And they'd be like, of course your dad loves you. And I'd be like, no, I'm pretty sure my dad doesn't love me. So for him to just say it point blank, I didn't love you, was both excruciating and liberating. Because it meant I wasn't crazy. And I tried telling my brothers and sisters what he said, but a lot of them didn't believe me, which I get. Like, who wants to think their dad doesn't love them? The way I see it now, I feel like they all got money, but I got something I needed, which was the truth.
So as mentioned before, this is from Neil Brennan's special, Three Mics, wherein one of the microphones is truly about the emotional past he has endured. And as you heard, there wasn't that much comedy in that monologue. He actually references that he has a one-man show license, which means it's not necessarily entirely a comedy show. He is a comic, but he's also a person, and he's performing a monologue for the audience. But in general, I just thought he did a really nice job. He definitely did find some of the jokes. But in general, I think even more importantly, he was communicating in such a way that a lot of the listeners were able to not only understand, but maybe develop new perspective on their personal situations. So props to Neil Brennan on that. Definitely an extremely hard bit to write down and perform. But that's what this episode is all about in personal comedy. Another ad from our sponsors.
I got got a stack of records here, a stack of records there. I got records scattered all over everywhere, but I'm looking for one.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting independent music for over 30 years, and it keeps on living by joining efforts with local music supporters such as Vinyl Records. You can find a selection of Vinyl Records' featured albums on the back cover of Discorder and can support your favorite local bands and artists by purchasing their records. For more information on their vast selection of new, used, and rare music, go to vinylrecords.ca.
Hey, we're back with Finding the Funny, already at the 20-minute mark. I wanted to reference Pete Davidson and the comedy he's created and the discussion he's put around his father, a 9/11 firefighter. So make sure you check that out. I believe he discusses it in one of the weekend updates on Saturday Night Live, as well as he discussed it in a whole bunch of interviews. And that will do it for today's episode of Finding the Funny and Personal Comedy. Props to all the comedians out there who are taking personal and hard subject matter and turning them into wonderful bits. Once again, to everybody listening, a huge, huge thank you. We appreciate your support and interest in the show. We're really, really growing with each episode and excited about the things we have coming up. Make sure you check us out at Finding the Funny on Twitter. That is where we'll be pushing most of our social media. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, keep on laughing. Coming up next, Exploding Head Movies at 7 p.m. You can join Gak as he explores music through the cinema. Right here on CITR 101.9.
Nikkei National Museum's Hastings Park 1942 exhibit marks the 75th anniversary of Japanese-Canadian internment. Visit the exhibit until January 13th to see Japanese Problem, a contemporary performance piece which offers a glimpse into a dark episode of history at the Pianese Livestock Barn. Nikkei National Museum is located in Burnaby and entry is by donation.
LGBTQ2I Night is a positive space for folks to learn about bike maintenance in a relaxed environment led by queer mechanics and volunteers. It takes place on the fourth Wednesday of every month at the Bike Kitchen on UBC's campus. Bring your own bike and fix them with our tools, come with questions and ask away, or learn by watching other folks work on their bikes. Beginners are always welcome. This event is entirely free to attend and there will be free pizza. For more information, visit bikecoop.ca.
Are You Aware Radio, alternate Thursdays 6 to 7 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. Profiling music and musicians take the route of positive action over apathy.
Yeah. you doing? This is Sean from Youth Brigade. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
This ad caught your attention. It also caught the attention of the coolest people from Squamish to Bellingham, music fans, students, and members of various cultural communities. If you want your ad to do the same, advertise with CITR and Discorder. If you've got a rad new ad or just something you want to share, whether in print, on air, or online, promote your wares, services, or events with us. Contact us at advertising@citr.ca or call 604-822-4342. Visit CITR.ca for rates, information, and packages. This is the end of our ad, and if you're still here, we must be doing something right.